Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of sources, extract the most important nuggets, and give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed.
That's right.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into the vibrant, sometimes surprising, and often opinionated world of pottery and ceramics.
It really is.
We're drawing insights directly from the shared wisdom and experiences of potters themselves, years of it, actually.
Yeah, this deep dive is really tailor-made for you. Whether you're a seasoned artist with clay on your hands, or maybe you're just starting your journey, or perhaps you're simply curious about the craft.
Right.
We'll explore the practical realities of working with clay, you know, from ancient hand-building techniques right through to cutting-edge modern innovations. And we'll even uncover some fascinating long-standing debates that continue to shape this field.
Yeah, some real hot topics.
Definitely. Our mission today is to give you a comprehensive understanding of what truly goes into creating with clay, all from the invaluable perspective of those who live and breathe it every day.
And we've assembled a true treasure trove of material for this deep dive. It's compiled from years of candid online discussions among potters.
Like eavesdropping on the expert.
Exactly. It's like having a backstage pass to a masterclass filled with surprising facts, practical advice, and, well, a real sense of the community. Ready to jump in?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's kick things off with a foundational question. This one sparks intense discussion in the pottery world. What does handmade truly mean?
Ah, the big one.
Yeah, you might think it's straightforward, but our sources show it's anything but. It really forces potters to grapple with some big questions.
It's fascinating, actually, how the definition of handmade has been evolving for millennia. I mean, think about it.
Okay.
When the very first potter's wheel emerged centuries ago, suddenly a potter can make pots maybe 10 times faster.
Huge difference.
Right. So for the hand builders of that era, these new wheel-thrown pieces might have felt, well, machine-made.
I can see that. Like cheating, maybe.
Sort of, yeah. Then came motor-driven wheels and eventually the jiggering wheel, which uses a mold and a spinning arm to rapidly shape pottery.
Okay.
Each of these innovations prompted these intense debates about authenticity, skill, and, you know, just how much a machine could be involved before a piece lost its handmade soul.
So if a machine is involved, even a simple wheel, does that piece still qualify as handmade?
That's the crux of it.
Some potters argue handmade means shaped only with the hands, period.
A very strict definition.
Very. And this would exclude anything jiggered, pressed, or slip cast, where liquid clay is poured into a mold, no matter how beautifully designed it is.
Right.
The exception maybe might be if these pieces are then substantially altered, you know, twisted or reassembled by hand. But this is where the debate really heats up.
Exactly. And this raises a crucial point. What level of skill is truly required to call something handmade? I mean, training factory workers to pour molds might take days, maybe a week. But mastering the art of throwing plastic clay on a wheel or skillfully hand-building complex forms, that often takes years, decades even.
That's a huge difference in investment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Consider this scenario.
Yeah.
If you wanted to change a design slightly, say, make a platter half an inch wider for mass production using molds or jiggering.
Yeah.
It would mean completely retooling, new molds, new setup. Big expense, big delay.
Right.
But for a hand-shaping potter, it's often just a matter of starting with a little bit more clay,
yeah.
Maybe adjusting their technique slightly.
Much more adaptable.
Totally. This kind of quick and easy evolution of form, this adaptability, is seen by many as the very essence of the craft's life, its vitality.
Ultimately, though, the sources suggest a pragmatic, if maybe a bit disheartening, truth.
Which is?
That the label handmade often just means whatever the customer assumes it does.
Mm-hmm.
And its value is assigned by them, not always by the potter or the process.
Hmm. The perception is key.
Yeah, the nuanced realities of production are often completely lost on buyers. One potter put it quite bluntly, actually.
Go on.
Said something like, if artists can't make work people want or make it accessible, then they can't really complain if customers buy elsewhere.
Oof. Harsh, but maybe realistic.
It almost feels like a challenge, you know? Artistic integrity versus market reality.
And that leads us nicely to a bigger picture about the integrity of the craft and the artist's role within it.
How so?
Well, some potters find the concept of the unknown craftsman, you know, that historical ideal, particularly within the Japanese Minjei folk art movement, where the artist stays anonymous.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
They find it, and this is a quote, a ridiculous conceit in the modern world.
Ridiculous? Why?
They argue that talent and time are wasted if artists work in anonymity. The call, for them, is to make noise with your work. Sign it proudly, get it seen.
Own it.
Exactly. It's about owning your contribution to the craft, making your mark.
Okay, moving from these fascinating philosophical discussions, let's literally dig into the clay itself.
Good idea. The hands-on stuff.
What happens from the moment it's sourced, or, as you hinted, in many cases, rescued, to when it's finally ready for shaping?
Right. Reclaiming clay. This means reprocessing unused or discarded clay to make it usable again. It's a vital part of studio practice for so many potters.
Saves money, saves resources.
Definitely. One potter mentioned being appalled when a friend gave away her pug mill. That's a machine that reprocesses, mixes, and de-airs clay because some professor had called reclaiming scrap a waste of time.
Wow, really? A waste of time?
Yeah, which is crazy to a full-time potter. For them, pug mills, even older models like a Bluebird Power Star from 1990 that was mentioned, they're absolutely invaluable. They save wrists from hours of hard physical labor and literally thousands of pounds of clay over time.
So it's about efficiency and sustainability, too.
Exactly.
But what if you don't have a pug mill? Or maybe you just prefer a more hands-on approach?
Then wedging is your friend. Wedging clay, that physical process of kneading and spiraling the clay, is absolutely key.
Why is that?
Well, it helps de-air the clay, first off. Ensures there are no air bubbles that could cause blowouts or cracks in the kiln.
Okay, critical.
And, maybe more philosophically, it brings you closer to the clay, as one potter put it. Really feeling the material.
I like that.
And, you know, another potter made a point about skill, saying something like, any dope can make a snake pot, handprint in clay, pinch a tiny pot. But to make high-class pots with just your hands is a really fine craft.
It really speaks to the dedication needed, doesn't it?
It does. And here's where the science of clay gets really interesting.
Right.
When clay is first mixed with water, it might not throw well on the wheel. It can feel short or just wrong.
Right.
But aging it, sometimes for weeks or even months, allows bacterial action to produce a slightly acidic environment in the clay.
Bacteria in clay.
Yeah, naturally occurring ones. And this acidity helps the tiny plate-like clay particles attract each other.
Yeah.
It makes the clay much more workable in plastic.
Okay.
This process is called flocculation.
Flocculation, got it.
But on the flip side, the vibration from a potter's wheel can actually have a deflocculating effect.
Yeah.
It can push those particles apart, making throwing almost impossible if the clay gets too dispersed or sloppy.
So the wheel can work against you sometimes?
It can. So to counteract this, some potters use a simple trick. Just a splash of white vinegar in their throwing water.
Vinegar, really?
Yep. The acetic acid helps flocculate the clay, especially if it's feeling a bit deflocculated. It essentially wakes up the clay, makes it nicely plastic again.
That's a great tip. So simple.
It is. And interestingly, Epsom salts magnesium sulfate also create a sulfuric acid state that can flocculate both glazes and clays. Chemistry in the studio.
Amazing. So that leads us to a related question. What about additives to the clay itself, not just in the water?
Right. Good question. Grog is a really common one.
Grog? Sounds like something a pirate would drink.
Huh. No, it's a general term for ground up, fired ceramic material, think finely crushed fire brick, essentially.
Okay, so pre-fired clay, ground up, what does it do?
It's added to the clay body to reduce plasticity slightly, but more importantly, it reduces shrinkage as the clay dries and fires. This makes the clay easier to handle, especially for larger pieces, and helps prevent cracking.
Makes sense.
For really monumental sculptures, potters might use very coarse grog, sometimes up to 30% by weight. They often supplement that with medium and fine grog, too, just to retain some flexibility in the clay body while building.
Interesting balance. Any other additives mentioned?
Yeah, wollastonite came up.
Wollastonite.
Yeah, it's a calcium silicate mineral. In its crystalline structure, it apparently works like tiny, twined, and interlaced little rollers to bind clay particles together.
Wow, like internal scaffolding.
Kind of. It helps create a smoother, stronger clay body. This is quite different from another additive mentioned, kyanite.
Kyanite, okay.
Kyanite forms needles jumbled together. Now, while it can cause problematic free silica tiny sharp particles that can be a health hazard after firing in stoneware bodies, it does work well for raku bodies, especially in the forming stage. But apparently, handling the raw kyanite can literally tear skin if you're not careful.
Ouch. Good to know.
Definitely handle with care. So, beyond the mixing and additives, proper drying is absolutely crucial. Get this wrong, and you risk cracks and warping.
Right. All that work ruined before it even sees the kiln.
Exactly. A good drying cabinet is invaluable. One source mentioned the setup at the John C. Campbell Folk School.
What's special about it?
It uses adjustable electric baseboard heaters and natural convection to dry the pottery evenly. And that's the key. The goal isn't just to dry slowly. It's to dry
evenly, not slowly. Got it.
Right. Controlling humidity is essential. A simple trick is wrapping cloth around the work, then putting it under plastic. This acts like a portable damp box to regulate the humidity, allowing the piece to dry gradually and uniformly from the inside out. And, you know, it's incredible to think about the longevity of this craft.
How so?
Even 8,000-year-old pots can still tell us so much. With modern dating techniques, they can now pinpoint the age to within 150 years or less.
Amazing. That really speaks to the enduring nature of working with clay.
It really does.
Okay, so once that timeless clay is formed and maybe dried carefully, the next layer of magic often comes from glazes.
Indeed. Once the clay is ready and often bisque-fired, that's fired once at a low temperature to make it solid but still porous.
Right, so it can absorb the glaze.
Exactly. Then the true alchemy happens with glazes. But as you said, this isn't just about pretty colors. It's a really complex chemical dance.
And glaze chemistry sounds critical. A common ingredient like Gerstle borate really highlights that based on our sources.
Oh, absolutely. Gerstle borate, a naturally occurring source of boron, is becoming incredibly expensive. We saw mentions of up to $500 a bag.
Whoa, $500 for glaze material.
Yeah. And beyond the cost, it's one of the biggest culprits in turning clear glazes milky or cloudy when they're applied thickly. This happens because of gas evolution during the firing process.
So it causes visual defects too.
It can. And this isn't just about finding a substitute. It highlights the surprising economic vulnerabilities of this ancient craft. A single ingredient's price hike can drastically shift the landscape for artisans.
So what are they doing?
Many are looking for alternatives, like Fritz.
Fritz?
Yeah, Fritz are basically pre-melted glass compounds ground into a powder. Something like Frit-31-3D4 is a common substitute for the boron in Gerstle borate.
But it's not a straight swap, right?
Not at all. Replacing Gerstle borate with Fritz requires careful adjustments, especially for glaze suspension, keeping all the solid glaze particles floating evenly in the water mix.
Why is that?
Well, Fritz don't provide the same natural flotation properties as a raw material like Gerstle borate. So potters often add bentonite, a type of very fine clay, sometimes up to 5% or even 8% for certain recipes, just to help keep everything suspended.
Another balancing act.
Always. But add too much bentonite or another flocculant, and you can cause other issues.
Like what?
Like poor wet glaze adherence. The glaze doesn't stick well to the bisque pot. Or cracking and flaking as the glaze dries, and even crawling during the firing where the glaze pulls away, leaving bare spots. Often this is due to oversaturation of the porous bisqueware.
It sounds like a minefield if you don't know your chemistry.
It can be.
Yeah.
And this brings us to a crucial point about safety and truly understanding what's in your ingredients.
Yeah, that seems important, especially for things people might eat off of.
Exactly. Some commercial glazes, surprisingly, lack detailed information about their coloring oxides or even their durability. This leads to real concerns about toxins, especially when making food-safe dinnerware.
Any specific examples?
Barium carbonate, for instance, is sometimes used for certain color effects, but it's labeled as a poisonous raw material in some glaze formulations. So potters are really strongly encouraged to understand their glaze recipes inside out and test them rigorously, not just for looks, but for safety too. Trust your own tested recipes.
Good advice. Now, when it comes to actually applying the glazes, consistency sounds key.
Absolutely critical. Potters often talk about measuring specific gravity.
Specific gravity. Okay, what's that?
It measures the density of the glaze mixture. Basically, how much solid material is suspended in the liquid, usually water.
So how heavy the glaze slurry is.
Right. But specific gravity doesn't fully describe the thickness or how freely a glaze flows. That property is called viscosity.
Ah, viscosity, like punny versus water.
Exactly. And viscosity can be influenced by adding tiny amounts of acid, maybe like hydrochloric acid, to thicken up a clay-heavy glaze.
Okay.
Or a base, like sodium hydroxide, to decrease viscosity, make it runnier.
More chemistry.
Always. And there's even a simple, low-tech way to measure this flow, just timing how long a measured amount of glaze takes to pour out of a standard funnel.
Practical. You know, it's interesting, despite all this complexity.
Yeah.
Many potters apparently don't even consciously think about things like flocculation in their glazes. They just use the same clay body and the same glaze recipes for decades because, well, it works for them.
If it ain't broke.
Right. Some sources even advocate for sticking to one good base glaze that really fits your clay body well, and then just learning how to color and layer that one glaze effectively.
We asked her one thing.
Yeah, rather than having, quote, 35 buckets of glaze lying around or constantly experimenting with hundreds of variations, it's a compelling argument for depth over breadth, maybe.
I can see the appeal. Less variables, more control, perhaps.
And tying into that idea of simpler, more traditional methods, even wood ash can be used in glazes. It offers an incredibly inexpensive option, especially when chemical supplies get pricey, like that Gersley borate.
Back to basics, using what's available.
Yeah, this connection to resourceful, time-honored practices is a recurring theme you see woven through the pottery community discussions. Really fascinating.
It is. From the earth back to the earth, in a way.
Okay, so from the clay and the glaze, we naturally move to the transformative power of fire itself.
The kiln, where the magic or sometimes disaster happens.
Exactly. Kilns and precise firing schedules are absolutely critical to the final outcome of any piece. They truly make or break it.
No question. And there's been an ongoing evolution in kiln technology, just like with other tools.
How so?
Well, kiln sitters were once the standard. Those were mechanical devices that use small, precisely formulated ceramic cones.
Oh, yeah, the cones that bend.
That's them. They'd bend at a specific temperature and trigger a switch to shut off the kiln.
Clever mechanical solution.
It was. But today, they've largely been replaced by digital controllers, electronic brains for the kiln.
More precise, more reliable.
Generally seen as more reliable, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they can often lead to heating elements lasting longer because the temperature control is smoother.
But not everyone's switched.
No, some potters still use both a controller and a kiln sitter as a backup, or even prefer the complete hands-on control of manual firing, watching the cones themselves. It really speaks to that balance between tradition and new tech again.
What I found truly fascinating here, though, was the spirited debate around firing speed.
Ah, yes. The fast versus slow argument.
Exactly. Some potters firmly argue that fast firing, for example, getting up to cone 10, which is a very high stoneware temperature, around 2350 Fahrenheit in just 7 hours.
That's quick for cone 10.
Right. They argue that can lead to lackluster or sort of dull, undeveloped glaze results.
Mm-hmm.
Yet others, like one potter who fires to cone 7 slightly lower but still high in under 5 hours, claim their pots have never been better.
Really?
Yeah, with almost nil rejects, provided, and this seems key, provided they have really good airflow and circulation within the kiln.
Interesting. So maybe it's not just speed, but how you fire fast.
That seems to be the implication. It's a real difference of opinion on what makes for an optimal firing.
It really highlights that glaze maturation isn't just about hitting a peak temperature number.
Right.
It's a result of both temperature and duration.
Yeah.
Time at temperature. Heat work, they call it.
Heat work. Okay.
If you rush the temperature ramp too quickly, it zooms ahead of maturation, as one source put it. This often leads to those dead, lifeless glazes.
So you need to give them time to cook properly.
Exactly. Slowing down the firing, especially near the end, during the final soak period, allows glazes to mature properly, smooth out, and develop their full depth and character.
Makes sense. What about the first firing, the bisque firing?
Good point. Bisque firings in particular really benefit from being extended, especially in the range above 1500 degrees or Athen or so.
Why is that?
To ensure all the organic materials and chemical water within the clay are completely burned out or driven off. Rushing this stage is a common cause of broken pots later on.
Patience is key then.
Very much so. And then there's downfiring or controlling the cooling cycle. That's also a critical, sometimes artistic, technique.
Cooling isn't just turning the kiln off.
Not always. Not if you want specific effects. For example, to enhance vibrant iron reds or certain shino glazes.
Yeah.
A kiln might be deliberately fired back up slightly, say to 1700, 1900 degrees F during the cooling phase, or purposefully held or downfired slowly for maybe 20 minutes around 1800 degrees F to develop bright copper reds.
Wow, so we're actively manipulating the cooling.
Yes, it's an active part of the firing process for a certain glaze effects, even after the peak temperature has been reached.
Fascinating. Now, kiln maintenance and safety must be huge topics, too.
Paramount. Absolutely paramount. And the sources share some wild stories.
I really like what?
Well, troubleshooting kiln problems often involves checking electrical relays, fuses, thermocouple connections. Standard stuff.
Hmm.
But one potter actually found a mouse nest totally burned and blocking the gas flow. In a burner system.
A mouse nest. You're kidding.
Nope. Sounds like something out of a cartoon, but it's a real fire hazard, obviously. Which is why proper wiring, excellent ventilation, especially critical for gas kilns, which produce carbon monoxide, and having working CO alarms are all absolutely essential. Non-negotiable.
Definitely. You might wonder too about how potters actually load their kilns. Is there a right way?
Well, there's the common misconception, apparently, or maybe a standard idea, that packing a fuel kiln, gas, wood, etc., absolutely full to the brim will lead to poor results and take forever to fire. But it seems it's more nuanced than that. While fuel kilns certainly need good air movement for combustion and heat distribution, it's more about avoiding creating dams that stop the flow of heat and air. You shouldn't just cram things in tight everywhere. Pots need sufficient room around them for that air to circulate freely, and there needs to be a clear path for the heat and combustion gases to travel towards the chimney or stack.
So strategic packing, not just maximum packing.
Precisely. It's about facilitating flow.
And even seemingly minor details can matter, right?
Oh, definitely. Like the age of your pyrometers, those devices that measure temperature, they can drift over time. Or even the kiln cones themselves. Old cones can apparently scum, meaning they don't deform correctly or reliably at their rated temperature.
So even the cones aren't foolproof.
Not entirely. And get this, large cones versus small cones of the same number rating can sometimes show up to a half cone difference in the total heat work they indicate.
Really? That's subtle.
It is. So while pyrometers are helpful aids, they shouldn't be fully depended on, especially for critical firings. Cones remain the gold standard for measuring the actual heat work delivered to the ware.
The cones tell the real story of the firing.
That's the idea.
Okay, beyond all these fascinating technical details of clay, glaze, and fire, our sources also revealed the incredibly personal journeys of potters.
Yeah, the human side of it.
Their unwavering dedication, the often tough financial realities, and their commitment to constant learning throughout their lives.
It's truly inspiring, actually. Reading about potters, even at 81 or 85 years old, who are, quote, still working on two new kiln designs and keeping the clay moving.
Wow, 85 and designing
I
kilns.
know. It reflects such a deep, enduring love for the craft. One potter called it their new 10-year program of keeping active.
That's fantastic.
Another potter notes that while living alone might have its challenges, having a well-set-up studio, maybe with sturdy 5-quarter, 10-inch oak board walls, as they mentioned, can bring a simple, profound daily joy.
The workspace matters.
Hugely. But the financial side, that can be incredibly tough.
Yeah, I gathered that.
Many potters, despite making literally many thousands of pots over their careers and even building kilns for other people, openly admit they have never made a living wage solely from their art.
Never. That's rough.
It is, and it often means relying on a partner's income or perhaps having inherited money to allow for things like travel for workshops, advanced training, or major studio development like buying that expensive kiln.
It really puts into perspective the incredible dedication required. It's not just a job.
It's a calling, often subsidized one way or another. And this brings us to a compelling question about how potters adapt, or maybe struggle to adapt, to a changing artistic landscape.
What do you mean?
Well, one potter shared an anecdote about an American clay center that invested heavily $60,000 on a new state-of-the-art blue kiln.
Okay, big investment.
Huge. The goal was to attract the brightest and best clay artists. What they found, according to this source, was that the new wave of contemporary artists often doesn't do kilns, clay, or glaze. Their focus is more on making conceptual statements, maybe using clay as just one component or not at all.
So the shiny new kiln wasn't the draw they expected for that group.
Apparently not. It highlights a fascinating tension between traditional craft skills and certain trends in contemporary art.
That sentiment really seems to echo a wider concern we saw within the community discussions about skill and knowledge, especially maybe across generations. One potter vividly recalled a shop teacher from her school days who explicitly disliked girls and thought they were stupid and unteachable in that environment.
Oh, that's awful.
And despite growing up learning practical things like carpentry and car repair at home, she was forced into taking home economics instead of shop class.
Ugh, old stereotypes blocking opportunity.
Exactly. And this anecdote was used to illustrate a perceived decline in practical, hands-on skills, and maybe even the valuing of those skills, particularly among younger generations, regardless of gender, a sort of disconnect from making things.
That's a common worry, isn't it? In many fields.
It seems so. And what about brand new tools like AI? How does that fit into the pottery world?
AI.
Yeah.
Well, the sources showed a mix of cautious curiosity and significant skepticism.
Okay.
While AI can certainly help with tasks like proofreading studio newsletters or maybe drafting some marketing copy.
Useful for the business side.
Potentially. But many Potters from our sources stated they would never rely on AI for health data or glaze information.
Why the hesitation there? Seems specific.
The concerns included AI essentially making up sources or information hallucinations, they call them. Also, incorrectly attributing writings or ideas to the wrong authors. And, interestingly, concerns about its significant energy consumption were also raised.
Right, the environmental cost of the computation.
Exactly. So the general consensus seems to be that AI has both positive and negative potential uses, but it must be used thoughtfully, critically, and ethically, especially when it comes to safety-critical info like glaze formulation.
Don't trust it blindly.
Definitely not. And through all these discussions, these debates, these shared tips, it's clear that the community of Potters itself is incredibly important.
Yeah.
Like those who participated for years in the longstanding Clay Art mailing list, which was a major source for this deep dive. That online space has been a vital source of shared wisdom, lively discussion, troubleshooting, and invaluable support.
A virtual studio community.
Precisely. And despite all the changes in technology, the economic pressures, the artistic debates, the underlying passion for clay, for the process, and the deep satisfaction of creation truly endures. You really feel that coming through.
So after digging through all this, what does it all mean for you, our listener? We've truly delved into the deep and wonderfully diverse world of pottery.
We really have.
From that very fundamental hands-on definition of handmade to the complex, almost magical chemistry of glazes and the constantly evolving technology of kilns.
And we've seen that pottery is so much more than just a set of techniques. It's really a lifestyle, isn't it?
It seems like it.
A continuous journey of learning, of adaptation, and a really profound connection to the materials, to the earth itself.
Yeah.
It's a field where ancient wisdom, thousands of years of it, seamlessly meets modern innovation. And often, as we heard, with some pretty spirited debate and passionate opinions thrown in.
Absolutely. Whether you're reclaiming clay with a splash of vinegar, meticulously tweaking a glaze recipe for safety and beauty, or thoughtfully considering the best way to fire your kiln, the insights gleaned from these dedicated potters offer invaluable lessons, I think, for anyone involved in creating anything, not just pottery.
That's a great point. And it really prompts an important final question for all of us to think about.
Okay, what's that?
In this era, where information is just so abundant, maybe overwhelming, but often fragmented or even unreliable, how do we best balance the time-honored traditions and the hard-earned practical wisdom of a craft like pottery with the relentless pace of new technologies, new materials, and constantly shifting definitions of art and craft? How will you choose to define your own approach to learning and making, embracing both the old and the new?
That's a deep one to end on. Keep exploring, keep learning, and most importantly, keep creating. We hope this deep dive has given you plenty to mull over.